all the big ideas seem to be on this small screen. I just want to be able to program them and watch them on a platform of my choosing. Is that too much for a boy to ask?
Journalist, friend, singular human, David Carr. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Whistleblowers nowadays are heralded in the media as heroes. That wasn't always the case.
The whistleblower is not liked. We have invidious terms for him. He is a fink, or a stool pigeon, a squealer, or an informer, or he rats on his employer.
Also, before Jon Stewart was the king of fake news, his career seemed a little stalled. Then came The Daily Show.
Hey, it looks like you have a real job.
Huh? That thing with Bennigan's came through?
There's more coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. John Kiriakou, a 14-year CIA veteran, left prison last week to serve the last 3 months of his 2.5-year sentence under house arrest. He says he landed in the clink because, in a 2007 ABC News interview, he had acknowledged the CIA's use of waterboarding, which the agency had not officially confirmed. But at that time, even though he had no firsthand knowledge of the practice, he said it worked on a captive named Zubeda, and he wasn't exactly condemning it.
Would you call it torture?
You know, at the time, no. These guys hate us more than they love life. And at the time, I felt that waterboarding was something that we needed to do. And as time has passed, I think I've changed my mind.
And with Zubeda, you think that was successful?
It was.
And bottom line, as you sit here now, do you think that was worth it?
Yes.
Now, the government says it wasn't the waterboarding comments that put Kiriakou behind bars. It was his disclosure in 2008 of a covert CIA operative's name to a reporter. But as he said later, he didn't see it that way. As far as he's concerned, he got jailed for whistleblowing.
You consider yourself a whistleblower, correct?
I do now. I didn't in the beginning, but I've come to learn that most whistleblowers don't believe they're whistleblowers in the beginning. I do meet the legal definition of whistleblowing, and that is someone who brings to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. And that's what I did.
Since lately we've been marinating in whistleblowers, we decided to dig in on that word. Ben Zimmer, executive editor of Vocabulary.com and language columnist for The Wall Street Journal, says it dates back to the beginning of the 20th century.
And the original whistleblowers, naturally enough, were people who actually blew whistles. So that would be like a referee in football or boxing who might blow the whistle in order to stop the proceedings. And then it just got extended in American slang. Blowing the whistle just meant put a stop to things. So, for example, in a story that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1909, there was a slangy use of this expression. Ah, say, Sadie, blow the whistle on that, can't you? Says I. So in that sense, blow the whistle on that just means just stop talking, just shut up.
Funny that blowing the whistle once meant to shut up. But in the 1930s, it took on a darker hue. It meant to snitch, to rat, to squeal.
So we see it in various groups, you know, the labor unions is one example. To be called a whistleblower in the context of labor unions, again, becomes the equivalent of being a rat or a fink. I mean, we think about dramatic depictions of this, like On the Waterfront.
You ratted on us, Terry!
I was ratting on myself all them years. I didn't even know it. And I'm glad what I've done to you. You hear that? I'm glad what I've done.
And it's not as if words like rat have vanished in our more enlightened era. Similar epithets were applied to Edward Snowden.
He's a punk. You know, like I said, he's a loser.
Hell no, he's not a hero.
He's done a great service.
He's a traitor.
I think he's either a defector or a traitor.
Look at that guy. The guy's a weasel.
What do other nations use?
The Dutch use the term bellringer, and the people climb the church towers to warn the town of danger.
Tom Devine is the legal director for the Government Accountability Project, which offers legal aid to whistleblowers.
The Russians use the term lighthouse keeper after those who shine lights on the rocks that otherwise would sink ships. The Zulus in Africa, they call them the lookouts. They nickname them the sentries. The Serbians, their word for whistleblowers, alarm raiser. what I kind of noticed is that it is the freedom to warn that's been captured in the term as it's used in many other countries.
And so it is in America, which is why the term is now one of honor, always applied to those leakers whose values we share. But when and how did a term once synonymous with stool pigeon take on the mantle of moral rectitude? Well, language maven Bill Zimmer says it happened in 1970 in Washington. But the more pertinent question is who did it? And to that he answers, Ralph Nader.
He wants to encourage whistleblowing in corporations, in government, in situations where there may be potentially damaging information, where there could be great pressure not to reveal that information.
So when he moves up to Washington in 1970, he starts giving speeches, asking whistleblowers to step up.
And then the following year, he's involved in organizing the Conference on Professional Responsibility. And he said at this conference, the whistleblower is not liked. We have invidious terms for him. He is a fink or a stool pigeon, a squealer or an informer, or he rats on his employer. But Nader successfully rehabilitates whistleblower as a term that it's okay to be one. In a way, it was really about branding, you could say. It became your civic duty. It became an ethical thing to do.
Nader's timing was good, too.
This is the era of the Pentagon Papers, and then a bit later, the Watergate investigations. And so this was very much in the mind of people that this kind of stepping forward could be seen as something positive when the government itself was very often seen as corrupt.
Somehow you wouldn't think of Ralph Nader, legendary consumer advocate, erstwhile presidential aspirant, as being into word rehabilitation. But you'd be wrong.
Well, when I got to Washington, I had read a few books on semantics, and one of them had a chapter called The Word is a Thing. So the only way you can make a word look good is to attach it to a good deed.
Ralph Nader.
A lot of our successes were traced back to conscientious employees who jeopardized their job and their pension, and spoke out on behalf of the public's right to know and the public health and safety. You recognize that's a huge asset in our countries to have conscientious employees who will not get along by going along, but will stand tall and speak out, even at the jeopardy of their own job and future income.
And you said we don't have an untainted word to describe these people?
No, there wasn't. I got early the idea that the press liked the word whistleblower. It was compressed with meaning, and we gave it a meaning of moral courage. We tried to make that whistleblower heroic.
But nothing elevates a word like legal recognition. Laws that protect federal employees, like the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which Nader championed and Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project spent more than a decade pushing through.
The Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act has been in existence for a little over 2 years. It's had a very positive impact on the agencies that interpret the law.
How so?
The loopholes have been closed that made the act irrelevant for almost everyone. And now people are getting their hearings and they're winning their fair share of the hearings because all the ways that the deck had been stacked were canceled. Congress took those cards out and put fair ones in.
The term whistleblower, as defined in the act, is not just a moral mantle, it's a legal one. Devine says that since the law has passed, his group hasn't lost a single case. Now it's defending John Kiriakou. Whatever Kiriakou's initial motivation may have been, according to Devine, now he is a whistleblower. Meanwhile, Nader is more interested in retiring words than rehabilitating them. Exchange white-collar crime, for instance, for corporate crime. Private sector for corporate sector. Settlements for colonies.
Oh, this is my favorite. Listen to this. The people who gouge you in the drug industry and the health industry are called providers, right? So, I mean, just think of the tremendous image elevation when you can be part of a trillion-dollar industry and you're given an image of philanthropy. Here's one for you, tort reform. This is restricting your rights if you're wrongfully injured from having your full day in court. And they call it tort reform. How about this one? The only ethnic group that now is slandered with impunity, you'll never guess. He welched on me. Okay, here's another one.
The book that inspired Nader is called The Tyranny of Words by Stuart Chase. He made me write it down. The lesson here, don't be ruled by the words institutions stamp on things. If they don't portray the truth as you see it, then do what Nader does. Rat them out. I mean, blow the whistle on them.
Talking to the hippies on the Watergate hiders. Talking to the people getting down at the go-go. Shake a tambourine, go and get yourself a whistle and blow.
Coming up, correcting the historical record of lynchings in the South using the first draft of history newspapers.
This is On the Media.
From the hippie school, y'all. Got a good religion, don't you be nobody's fool, y'all.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With a story about how reading the paper can actually bring us closer to the truth. By combing through contemporaneous newspapers as well as official records, the Equal Justice Initiative added 700 victims to the list of more than 3,200 African Americans already known to have been lynched between 1877 and 1950. And that's just in the 12 southern states studied from Texas to Virginia. The initiative wants to commemorate the now corrected record by placing markers at some of the lynching sites. But most important, says law professor Brian Stevenson and director of the Equal Justice Initiative, it seeks to reclassify the great northward migration of African Americans as an exodus of refuge from terrorism.
There was an awareness that if you were white and you were offended by some person of color, not just victimized with a crime, but offended, you had the latitude to respond to that in any way you wanted. And if that included lethal violence, torturous violence, and lynching, you were going to be protected. And in my view, that made all lynchings of African Americans during this era systematic.
You assert that even if a mob does form spontaneously, the prevailing sentiment of permission took any sense of spontaneity out of the event. It just became part of an overall social pathology.
You'd see in some of the imagery from these events, people posing next to the victim's dangling body because there was no sense of shame. There was no sense of legal liability following these things. The true evil of slavery, in my opinion, was not involuntary servitude. The true evil of slavery was this narrative of racial difference, this ideology of white supremacy, this notion that these black people are not fully human. And the difficulty we have in this country is that our 13th Amendment, which prohibited involuntary servitude, didn't deal with the narrative. And in that respect, I don't believe slavery ended at the end of the Civil War. It just evolved.
Every white person was fully deputized in the shadow system of justice.
That's exactly right. And once the federal troops left at the end of Reconstruction, people were encouraged to use violence to enforce compliance. Some of the lynchings that we highlight in our report reveal this. There was a man named Jesse Thornton who was lynched in Laverne, Alabama, 1940, for referring to a white police officer by his name without the title of Mr. And he was grabbed, and he was killed. In 1919, a white mob in Blakely, Georgia, lynched William Little who was a returning soldier from World War I, an African American man, and they were antagonized by him wearing his army uniform, and so he refused to take his uniform off, and he was lynched. A man named Jeff Brown in 1916 was running through Cedar Bluff, Mississippi to catch a train. He bumped into a white girl, and he was lynched. The idea that he had someplace important to be that might cause him to even casually bump into this white woman was an offense of disorder, and so he was lynched. And that kind of violence, that kind of oppression was being enforced only because there was this system that did deputize every white person to engage in this kind of subordination.
I'm puzzled as to how contemporaneous newspaper accounts of lynchings and other violence against Southern blacks provided a whole lot of information for you. It would suggest that there was some degree of sympathy or fact-finding in the reporting at the time, which, well, it would be a shock to me that Southern papers were even-handed in their coverage of these vigilante crimes.
Oh, they clearly were not. When you look at the coverage, it's often quite celebratory. And so we were able to understand the ugliness of it because they didn't see it as ugly, and they were therefore comfortable detailing it, how many times the person was shot, how much mutilation took place, how the person was carved up, whether there was collateral violence directed at other black homes and black churches and black community members. All of that would sometimes be detailed, both because it served to reinforce the narrative and to expand the terror. But it's also true that the source of a lot of our information was actually a very strong and robust black media, a black press. There were dozens of black newspapers that formed all over the country that became quite attentive to these acts of violence. They were trying to document them to show the federal government that there was a need to return the federal troops. There was a need for federal intervention and protection. It's really in reviewing those sources that had not been exhaustively reviewed before that we found a lot of the really rich detail surrounding these lynchings.
You assert that we have historically misunderstood the great migration northward by African Americans who we have long assumed to have been seeking opportunity in the large industrial cities of the North when they moved in the years mainly surrounding World War II. And you say that the evidence that you have gathered suggests that they were not seeking opportunity, but fleeing terror.
Throughout the 20th century, the experience of African Americans in the South was very different than the experience of others. These weren't people heading to the West in response to the Dust Bowl or the Depression. These were people, many of whom fled between 1900 and 1925 as this violence began to peak. And we did lots of interviews with people who were telling us about what they called near executions, where they would send their son or their daughter or their husband or their parent to the North because they'd had an encounter with some white person in town and they weren't sure if the mob might not show up that night. And looking at the evidence around some of these lynchings, it was a shock to me to find out how often the last words of a lynching victim would be, tell my people to flee. And in interviewing the children and grandchildren of some of these lynching victims, there was no question that they fled as refugees. And even when you look at these cities that are now strongly influenced by a large black population, Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Oakland, you look at the history of people of color in these communities, they weren't actually given great jobs when they came. And in many ways, they continue to remain marginalized. They achieve some measure of security from the kind of overt terrorism that lynching represented, but they were still subordinate. And that's why I think that you cannot understand this migration without understanding the terrorism that inspired it.
You wear another hat, and that is to provide defenses and appeals for those on death row, perhaps unjustly convicted or inappropriately sentenced to death. Mm-hmm. I assume that you see a far more than casual association between today's criminal justice system and the legacy of lynchings in the South. Or am I overstating the case?
No, I think there absolutely is a continuing problem in America that is rooted in our failure to deal more honestly with this history in the past. There's been a lot of protests recently in response to police shootings of unarmed black men, and these protests are responses to not just a single incident in Ferguson or Staten Island. It's in response to lives being lived where people feel targeted and menaced by the police. I work in a criminal justice system where I've seen that presumption of guilt send many innocent people to jails or prisons for crimes they didn't commit. I've even been in a courtroom as an attorney and been the target of some of this. I was in a courtroom in the Midwest not that long ago, sitting at the defense counsel's table with my suit on, and the judge walked out and he saw me sitting there by myself and he said, hey, you get out of here. I don't want any defendant sitting in my courtroom by themselves. You go back out there in the hallway and wait until your lawyer gets here.
Oh, my goodness.
Had to stand up and say, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't introduce myself. And the judge started laughing and the prosecutor started laughing, and I made myself laugh because I didn't want to disadvantage my client. But afterward, I was thinking about that. What is it about this judge when he sees a middle-aged black man in a suit and a tie sitting at defense counsel's table? It doesn't occur to him that's the lawyer. When I think about that judge dealing with young defendants of color, do I think that those presumptions are going to disadvantage those young defendants? I absolutely do.
You are not a historian. You're a law professor. And yet here you are presuming to rewrite the history of the 20th century. I wonder if you've gotten any pushback from historians and others in academia to your presumption to, you know, kind of tread on their turf.
We have a different vantage point. We're investigating racial history. We're investigating the story of how these communities were affected by these narratives of racial difference. And if anything, we've gotten a lot of encouragement from historians who I think would admit that they have too frequently focused on discourse among academicians. Now, the reason why I want to put up markers and monuments is because I want people in the spaces to talk more truthfully about what that history represents. You go to Germany now and you are forced to confront the legacy of the Holocaust because that society has made a determination that it can't ignore that ugly reality. They can't be silent about it. They've got to talk about it. We do the opposite in America, and I don't think we can leave it just to historians to change that.
Brian, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Brian Stevenson is Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative and Professor of Clinical Law at NYU.
Now another instance of correcting the historical record, this time in the form of an apology. Back in 2006, the Charlotte Observer and Raleigh's News and Observer apologized in separate editorials for their part in a little-known chapter of American history. In North Carolina, 116 years ago, a biracial coalition of Republicans and populists had for some years controlled two Senate seats, the governorship, and a legislative majority. Supporters of the so-called fusion movement were mostly white, but in some counties, black men held elective office too. All that came to a bloody end one November night in what's known as the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898. Spurred on by the local press, white mobs set fire to black-owned businesses and overthrew the city's fusion government. They killed dozens of blacks and ran thousands out of town.
Finally, in the year 2000, a state commission was created to investigate the episode. The commission concluded that the horror in Wilmington was not so much a riot as an insurrection, a coup d'etat orchestrated by prominent members of the Democratic Party. They wanted to topple the fusion government, and though they had big business on their side, as well as a number of regional papers, that wasn't enough. They needed the poor white farmers. And so, as Duke Professor Timothy Tyson told us a few years back, the Democrats used the printing press to paint the conflict in black and white.
So they put this red-hot, scurrilous, very sort of sexually oriented, near-pornographic material out in the newspapers about the sort of black beast, black brutes, especially in the counties that had heavy black majorities. What you had to do was to shame white men who had voted with black men and say that they had failed to protect their women folk. They tried to shame white men into voting race instead of sticking with their economic interests.
Can you give me some specific examples of headlines or articles or cartoons that were inciting violence and racial hatred?
Well, for example, there's a cartoon of a big black vampire-like thing with wings, the incubus of Negro domination, you know, carrying off white women in its claws. The News Observer would run a cartoon of a white woman taken before a black magistrate, for example, and the black magistrate, you know, being licentious as if, you know, oh, we're, you know, you're in trouble, are you? And then acting as though they would be sexually taking advantage of this. They interpreted any kind of self-assertion on the part of black men as really being about sexuality, you know, about taking white women.
There's a temptation to see this as kind of an interesting historical footnote, but it's more than that. It was really a watershed event for the politics and governance of North Carolina for a century.
Oh, this is the most important political event in North Carolina's history, with the exception of the Civil War. When we had a coup in North Carolina and the federal government did nothing, President McKinley never even uttered the word Wilmington. What that did was send a signal that you can run black people out of public life in the South, no holds barred, and we quickly see this happening. Georgia had a very similar campaign in 1906 that was really modeled on what had happened in North Carolina quite consciously. That becomes the heyday of lynching. This becomes the time of disfranchisement all across the South where black people lost the vote. So it's not just a North Carolina event. It's really an event of national importance.
And the newspapers in Georgia and elsewhere in the South, did they mimic the News and Observer in its racial browbeating?
The News and Observer, the Atlanta Constitution, the Times-Picayune in Louisiana, the Washington Post, all of really sort of the Democratic Party papers of that era follow this line. And this campaign broke a lot of ground with that, actually, because you don't see this type of stuff during slavery, for example. You don't see this idea in the white media that somehow the enslaved black men are a threat to white women. But when black men wished to be citizens, somehow the closer a black man got to a ballot box, the more he looked like a rapist. And you see these same images echoing into the 1970s and beyond.
Now, the commission didn't simply report what happened in this remarkable bit of history. It also offered suggestions for concrete steps that local government could take to begin to right some of the wrongs, reparations for heirs of victims and for minority business grants and so forth. But also, it suggested that the newspapers, which exist today under very different ownership and different ideology, should also address their own complicity with minority scholarships and, of course, a commitment to write about this chapter of history. Do you believe that newspapers should be in the reparations business?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't think that private payments to individual citizens are really going to do much to fix the damage that's been done. And I would also just say that the News and Observer, really, since 1998, on the 100th anniversary of the Wilmington Race Riot, has spent a lot of newsprint reporting on their own role back in the white supremacy revolution. The Greensboro paper and the Charlotte paper have done the same thing. So I don't think that they bear any great stigma. They've been very honest about how things were.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Enjoyed being with you.
Timothy Tyson is senior scholar for the Center of Documentary Studies at Duke University. He's also the co-author with David Soselsky of Democracy Betrayed, the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and its Legacy. With the economic model of newspapers in disarray, going digital has meant more stories, more provocative headlines, more clicks to generate ever less revenue. The jingle.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
In his book, Geeks Bearing Gifts, Jeff Jarvis, a professor and champion of social journalism, argues that a new wave on the web has and must come to tide. The relationship business, he says, might offer journalists a better way to serve the public in more efficient and enduring fashion.
We have to stop thinking of journalism as a content factory, and we have to rethink it as a service. If my local newspaper knew more about me, gave me greater relevance, it would get greater engagement from me, it would get higher value advertising for me, and I think that a relationship-based strategy is where we have to shift journalism.
What does a relationship-based model look like compared to the content factory that was so availing for so long?
Let me give you an example after Hurricane Sandy. My information needs in New Jersey were clear. I needed to know what streets were open, when the power was coming back, and which Starbucks had Wi-Fi. What did news give me instead? It gave me articles which summed everything up to say, well, a lot of trees down, a lot of power out, as if I didn't know that. If instead we thought of journalism as a platform where communities can share their own knowledge and we could share what streets are closed and where the nearest Starbucks is with Wi-Fi and where we can get gas, that's a way to rethink what we do and what our role is in a larger ecosystem of news.
Now, just to be clear, I don't want to make this all about the commerce. You believe that the relationship model also serves the journalism in very specific ways.
What we're used to doing in journalism is deciding what's important and then writing about it. I think the process of journalism doesn't start with the story. The process of journalism necessarily starts with listening to the public and only then finding the best mechanisms to help the public meet their needs. If all we do is keep churning out 400 pieces of content a day, the same to everyone, then that's not a great service. And I think we have to reinvent other ways to help communities come together and share what they know, which, by the way, also makes us more efficient. News can be a lot more efficient. If you look at Google News on a plane crash, you'll see 2,000 versions of the same story. Well, why? That's mass media economics. That says everybody has to have their own take on the same story so we can get our own page views and our own mass volume. What we need to do is shift to other models where we start to reward relevance, quality, originality. Yes, we'll still do articles when they are appropriate, but we'll also make tools, convene people to get together, and we should judge our success not by eyeballs by the ton. We should judge our success as to whether or not people have improved their lives and their communities. We may end up looking more like community organizers. That's a different, perhaps heretical way to look at journalism.
Now, I'm sure legacy publishers would much rather hear you say, instead of that there is a new ecosystem a-brewing, that you have some magic beans for keeping the lights on. Not only don't you have that, and not only have you cited chapter and verse in your book about why the economics of mass media don't work anymore, having mainly to do with the plummeting prices that advertising fetches, you have questioned the very purpose of mass media anymore, because advertising no longer needs, you say, a particular publication as a proxy for the audience it wants to reach. Can you explain?
I may not have magic beans, but I think I do have a little bit of fertilizer here, Bob.
That has been said of you for many, many years.
You're welcome, Bob. You owe me one. When you look at Amazon, at a pair of boots, let's say, those boots are made for walking, following you around the internet for weeks, right? That's because the data about you and your purchase interest is more valuable than the editorial context, you know, putting a boot ad next to a boot story. Well, there we lose because we don't know our readers. But if we can start to learn our readers and learn what they need, then we can get our own, as it's called, first-party data. I've talked to newspapers, Bob, who went so crazy trying to bring in traffic through search engine optimization and social likes and so on. They ended up with a lot of traffic outside their markets, though they have advertising sales only inside their markets. So I asked them, what's the difference in value from an inside to an outside user? And it was a 20 to 25 time multiple. That's to say, if you just knew whether a user was in your market, you could multiply their value immensely.
You get more for serving an ad to them. You get more money from the advertiser.
Exactly. You also probably, if you serve them more relevance, you get more engagement and more traffic from them and more value. That's an important starting point.
But do you have any hope whatsoever that rethinking the purpose of a news organization and rethinking the way the publication engages with its readers has any possibility of restoring the levels of profitability that made this a really, really good business for a long time?
God didn't grant us monopolies, Bob. But we do have a role in society, and I do believe that journalism can pay for itself. I think that there are young people, certainly, who can reinvent journalism, and I even think the big old companies are starting to wise up. Is there time? Well, we'll see.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, and thank you. Thank you very much.
Jeff Jarvis is director of the Tao Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. He also writes the blog BuzzMachine.com and is author of the new book, Geeks Bearing Gifts, Imagining New Futures for News.
Coming up, Jon Stewart as you've never heard him, or at least not in the last 17 years.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This has been quite a week for comings and goings in the media, occasioned by death or dishonor or simply being done. It's not our job to mark all of them, but we will address two. First, Jon Stewart. We've spent much time on and stolen much tape from the crucially important programs pioneered by Stewart and his merry band of pranksters. You know who they are. And we've all heard year after year how The Daily Show, quote, makes me feel like I'm not crazy. But Stewart's Daily Show did much more than create a corner of painfully hilarious rationality. It gave our craven and inconsistent leaders no place to hide from their own self-incriminating statements.
I mean, the only obstacle to Mitt Romney winning next year's Republican nomination is that up until very, very recently, he was the antithesis of everything Republicans stand for.
Look, I was an independent during the time of Reagan Bush. I'm not trying to return to Reagan Bush.
I do not take the position of a pro-life candidate. I'm in favor of preserving and protecting a woman's right to choose.
But now it's 2011. He's not an irresponsible kid in his mid-50s anymore. He's matured and learned an important lesson about wanting to be elected president. Yes, Mitt Romney has a little bit of a problem. And that to win the Republican nomination, he has to convince Republican voters he's not actually Mitt Romney.
I am a pro-life.
Yeah, I'm pro-life, as in, hey, I lied before. That's life.
We at On the Media always jealously imagined scores of well-educated Daily Show interns trolling through hours of tape to produce all those horrifyingly delicious proofs of hypocrisy. Nightly, we got a clear-eyed lesson in integrity and the lack thereof. Let's hope the lesson sticks, because at some unspecified time, but soon, he'll leave us, like Mary Poppins sailing away on the wind. Also like Poppins, I wonder how he'd feel about that analogy. He arrived as something of a mystery. I happened to be present at that moment. Back in 1998, neither of us had a show, but I was filling in for NPR's Scott Simon and got to interview Stewart as he was just about to slip into his fake anchor chair. Here's that interview. Jon Stewart is a comedian who's been teetering on the brink of success for about 3 years now. He had a talk show on MTV. It was briefly syndicated. David Letterman's Worldwide Pants signed him to do a show following Tom Snyder's Late Late Show on CBS. That didn't pan out. Instead, Stewart guest-hosted Snyder's show amid speculation that he would eventually take it over. At the same time, he played a fictional character who was guest-hosting the fictional Larry Sanders show on HBO amid speculation that he would eventually take it over. That didn't pan out either. But finally, things are panning out, and Mr. Stewart is in our New York bureau. Hey, it looks like you have a real job.
Huh? That thing with Bennigan's came through?
What is it?
I'm a night manager again.
Tell me about Comedy Central.
The Comedy Central gig is The Daily Show, a fine and satirical look at the way the media has turned the country upside down. It starts in January. I'll be taking over for Mr. Kilbourne at that point.
And at that point, Kilbourne will be going over to the Tom Snyder Show, where you were for a while heir apparent. What happened there?
Kilbourne will go into Snyder. Snyder will be taking over for Rosie. Rosie will be hosting Hollywood Squares, and Tom Bergeron will be. It's like musical chairs.
So why on earth would you want to be a talk show host?
I really am interested in what Tia and Tamara Mowry think about and what goes into the making of Sister Sister. And I think until I can find that out, I'm just going to have to interview everyone else until I can get to them.
Which brings us to your new book of essays called Naked Pictures of Famous People, another example of blatantly false advertising.
Well, that's the most downloaded phrase, I think, on the internet, the most searched for phrase. So I figure if you want your porn backdoor action, you're going to also have to deal with my book.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Like a day. That's not true. It took me about 8 months.
Well, there's no naked pictures in the book, but there are a lot of famous people who are all viciously sent up.
Hey. Ranging all with love, all with respect.
The characters range from Martha Stewart to Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci to Lenny Bruce. Yeah. JFK is shown as a sadistic, inbred anti-Semite.
But in a positive, he's funny. Boy, that's right. You know, I hadn't strung all the adjectives together. When you put it that way, I think, oh, my God, I'm a bastard.
Gerald Ford is portrayed as a kind of lobotomized Pee Wee Herman. So the question that leaps to mind is, are you trying to be offensive?
No, I'm trying to be funny. Hopefully you don't take the book as just a slam on these people. It's really, I'm using them as absurd examples of the kinds of situations I'm talking about. But I'm not really slamming these people in particular.
Right.
I don't think it's a mean – I feel like it's not a mean book. I don't feel like I'm a mean person.
Yeah. So when, you know
– oh, man.
So John F. Kennedy stands by while –
my cynical friend.
John F. Kennedy stands by while his chote roommate is literally amputated by his inbred and deformed cousins.
It's absurd. Who would believe that there is a bunker underneath Hyannisport filled with miscreants and carny rejects that are genetically related to the Kennedys? It's absurd. It's a joke.
One of my favorite sections is your comparative chart of Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Judaism.
Yes, that was years of study.
And on the matter of homosexuality,
yes.
The Orthodox say it's a sin.
Yes, they do.
The Conservatives say it's a sin, but oh, what they've done for Broadway theater.
Yes, that's true.
And the Reform call it something that happened at camp.
Yes. See, that's funny.
The funny thing is when I saw you on Larry Sanders, I never would have guessed you were Jewish.
You got to be kidding me. My God, they had a nostril cam hooked up on that show. Never been to Brooklyn, my friend.
I live in Brooklyn.
Is that true?
Yes.
You live in Brooklyn and I don't look Jewish?
What about the business that I started with, fame? Has this been a fun ride for you or has it been frustrating or both?
Oh, I think fun. You know, somebody asked me the other day, they said, do you feel like you've done anything great? I said no. And then I thought, no, I have. And the one thing I did that was great was I moved from Trenton, New Jersey to New York to try and become a comedian. That's the one thing I've done in this business that's great. Because I gave myself the opportunity to express whatever it was that I thought I needed to express.
And you're from Jersey.
Yep. From Jersey.
From Trenton.
Yeah.
Trenton makes the world
taste. Don't start slamming. Let me tell you something. You ever drank champagne or seen Trojan rubbers?
Sure, I have seen Trojan rubbers.
Exactly. There you go. Well, there, your weekend is sponsored by Trenton. We used to make steel, but now we just make weekends. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Actually, the funniest essay in this book involves a talk show host, Larry King, up close and personal with Adolf Hitler. Now, we actually asked Larry King to read the Larry King part, but for some reason, he said no.
Yeah, he can't read. No, he's a very nice man. I actually met him, and he's actually a very pretty interesting and funny guy.
We asked Mike O'Mara, who is the co-host of the syndicated Don and Mike show, to play Larry King, which he was very happy to do. You played Hitler, and here we go.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight we bring you perhaps the most controversial show in the history of Larry King Live. He began his career as president of the fledgling National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party, in Germany. After a failed coup, some prison time, and a best-selling book, he reestablished himself in the German hierarchy, first as Chancellor and then as Führer. The next 10 years under his watch saw Germany's return to power, shame at the Munich Olympics, a failed marriage, and finally, one hell of a world war, complete with what was thought to be a cowardly demise by his own hand. Tonight, risen from the proverbial dead, we welcome Adolf Hitler.
First of all, Larry, I don't know what I was so afraid of. These bagels in the green room are delicious.
Well, Chancellor Hitler, I have
please call me Adolf.
Adolf, yes. Well, first of all, I have to say, quite frankly, we were very reluctant to have you on.
Well, I can't say I blame you for that. I mean, you hear the name Hitler.
Well, in the end, we decided this show is about newsmakers. That's been my motto through 40 years of broadcasting, and critics be damned. I'm not about to stop now.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What do you say to all those people out there, the people who view you as a demon, the perpetrator of the most vicious and incredible...
Guilty as charged. Larry, look, I was a bad guy. No question. I hate that Hitler.
And this new Hitler?
I get up at 7, have half a melon, do the jumble in the morning paper, and then let the day take me where it will. The other day I spent 7 hours in the park watching ants cart off part of a sandwich. Me! The inventor of the Blitzkrieg. You know, when you stop having to control everything, it's very freeing.
Oh, why did you do it?
Whew, boy, the $64,000 question, huh? I wasn't a happy kid. I mean, I'm not trying to make excuses, but you go through high school with one testicle and the nickname Shitler. I'm sorry, they can bleep that, right?
Did you ever see the despicable nature of your actions? Was there any remorse?
Oh, sure, but denial is a powerful thing. I always thought I could stop any time I wanted. If I could just get Czechoslovakia, that'll be the end of it. I'll be happy then. And I'd get it and think, well, geez, Poland's just up the road a piece, and you know the rest. I think admitting to myself that there was a problem was the toughest part.
Yeah, tell us about those final days in the Berlin bunker, where until now we had assumed you had killed yourself.
Yes, right. Well, funny story. Everyone thought I went into the bunker to escape.
Not the case?
No. Actually, as the Allied forces are closing in, I was still in denial. I really thought we were going to rally, you know, make an end run around Switzerland and flank them. So I'm planning furiously and snapping at people, you know, as my therapist says, playing the dictator.
Uh-huh.
So Ava calls me down to the bunker for some emergency with the generators. So anyway, I go down, and there's Ava and Himmler and two of my other closest friends, and I'll never forget. I walk in and say, "Was ist los?"
Oh.
And Ava takes my face in her hands, looks me in the eyes, and says, "Adolf, we all love you very much. But if you don't stop with this conquer and purify thing, no one in this room will ever talk to you again!"
Well, what happened?
I shot them.
After all these years, why resurface and open yourself up to the incredible tumult that your return has created?
Stay off the radar. No, that's a good question. See, I had been talking a good game for many years now. What a changed man I was, how I'd found real peace. But I was still playing the blame game. My therapist challenged me to put up or shut up, to prove to myself that I could take responsibility for my life. So, here I am.
We've been talking with Adolf Hitler. The book is...
Is it over already?
I'm afraid so.
That was fast. I thought I was the one who had ways of making you talk. But seriously, the book is called Mein Comfortable Shoes. You get it?
I do.
Yes. It's about an angry man who learns to appreciate the little things in life. It's about acceptance.
And what's next for Adolf Hitler?
Well, I'll be doing Politically Incorrect next Thursday. And as always, you can see my old work on the A&E Network. And in 2 weeks, I will be appearing on Court TV as I stand trial for crimes against humanity.
What kind of defense will you be offering?
Not much. I fully expect that by this time next year, I'll have been convicted, possibly put to death. But I'm going to represent myself, though, because from now on, the blame goes here. The only one to blame for Hitler is Hitler. Yeah, besides, who wants to get involved with a bunch of phony baloney defense lawyers? I mean, talk about evil.
Well, Adolf, thanks so much for coming by.
Danke schön.
I think that's all we need to say. The once and future Jon Stewart is the upcoming host of The Daily Show on the Comedy Central cable channel. That starts in January. And he's author of Naked Pictures of Famous People.
Of all the momentous media news of the past few days, Jon Stewart, Brian Williams, the death of CBS's Bob Simon in a car wreck, the biggest gut blow in these studios was the sudden death of David Carr, media columnist for the New York Times. David was a great friend to this program, cherished for his twin gifts. The first was his insight, saying the sensible thing we hadn't considered, a quality that informed his writing throughout his eccentric and perilous odyssey to the top. Here he was back in 2010, long before Tahrir Square, explaining why Twitter wasn't merely a forum for self-involved trivia.
In that maddening moment when you're standing at Starbucks, right, and the person just won't make your latte no matter what you do, all of a sudden you drift off into Twitter, and when you look up 5 minutes later and your drink is finally done, you're a little bit smarter for it. Things blow up on Twitter frequently before they show up in the media.
His other gift, treasured by his countless fans and followers, was saying exactly the thing we've considered in a way we never would have considered saying it. Here was David looking inward after gawking at a New York Post photo of a man killed by a subway train.
I felt a little dirty when I looked at it, and I sort of shot the next frame in my mind, which was full of gore and mayhem, and I thought, I don't feel too good about staring at this, because it feels like this guy is getting run over twice, and I'm on the train.
In every sense, David Carr had a singular voice, derived from his singular and terrifying biography of addiction, crime, and cancer. He's been called the greatest timesman, which is probably silly. But he did not keep his gifts to himself. He bestowed them generously, provocatively, and courageously on all of us. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sara Abdurrahman, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, and Kasia Mihailovich. We had more help from Reem Abdu, Andrew Chug, and Jesse Brenneman. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was David Grinbaum. Laura Mayer, our beloved producer of quirky masterpieces, like the report on the demise of Cat Fancy magazine, has moved on. And we wish her nothing but love and best wishes. We miss you already, Laura.
Oh, yes, we do. And we hope you fulfill all your spreadsheet desires, Laura. She's very organized. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.